learned this morning that fellowship with Jesus Christ is inseparably bound up with fellowship with each other. That our vertical fellowship with Christ is part and parcel with our horizontal fellowship with each other. And that no one can claim to be in fellowship with Jesus Christ if he ignores the legitimate responsibilities that he has to his fellow members of the body. To be connected and in fellowship with the head implies that you're in fellowship with the other members of the body who are also in fellowship with that head. Now, I was thinking just a moment ago, the parable that Jesus told about the last judgment in Matthew 25 is probably the most graphic illustration of that we could have. It's in that place that Jesus told those who came before him, "Truly I say to you, as you did it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you did it unto me." And then to those on his left hand, when he says, "Depart from me, I never knew you," he'll say to them, when they said, "Well, when did we see you like this?" He said, "Truly I say to you, as you did it not to one of the least of these, you did it not to me." So you see, he's saying there is no such thing as fellowship with him that is not expressed in fellowship to each other. And that there's no such thing as kindness or benevolence expressed to him that is not expressed to those who are our fellow Christians here in life. We also notice that the word fellowship, koinonia, has many different facets of meaning. But the one that Paul, we're going to be talking about tonight, is that Paul uses this same word, the exact word, koinonia, as he discusses fellowship in the sense of collection, or fellowship in the sense of the sharing of our material possessions with others who are not quite so fortunate. Now, there are some examples where Paul uses the word koinonia as, well, virtually a synonym for the word collection. Now, let's look for just a moment. There's one passage in Acts, the second chapter, that I don't know about. I know it's been applied like this by brethren for many years. Acts 2:42, many brethren have gone to this passage and have found four of the five acts of worship that we usually refer to. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. The word fellowship there probably does involve the sharing that they were involved in. But there are other passages that even you don't have to conclude that it refers to it. It actually says it explicitly. For example, there are some statements to the Corinthians. If you'll turn over to 2 Corinthians, the 8th and 9th chapters, let's get four references here under our belt before we go any further. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 4. Beginning in verse 3, Paul says, "For they," that is the Macedonians, "gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own free will, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints." Now, the word there, "taking part in," comes from the word koinonia. They begged us for the grace, or the favor. They begged us earnestly for the favor of taking part in, or for the favor of being partners with this collection or the relief of the saints. Look over at the chapter 9 and verse 13. Now, all of this is still talking about the collection. "Under the test of this service, you will glorify God by your obedience in acknowledging the gospel of Christ and by the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others." The word there for contribution is the word koinonia. Now, it's just translated like that. Is there any other translation that you have that translates it differently? Generosity and sharing, all right? The word sharing there is the word, would be translated the word from the word koinonia. Any other translation that you can think of that you have in front of you? That is either sharing or contribution. All right, those two references now were spoken and written to the Corinthians who were involved in the contribution themselves. The Macedonians to whom Paul is referring. And then he's also asking the Corinthians to be a part of this contribution for the poor saints in Jerusalem. Now, the Corinthian church to whom this correspondence was sent, they were involved in it. There's something that came to my mind, though, tonight in some final preparation. Over in the Roman letter, chapter 15, let's look at that reference to the Romans. And the interesting thing about this is that the Romans were not a part of that contribution. Now, I don't know what to do with that. I just don't know. I just know that he does not ask them to contribute to the poor saints in Jerusalem. Brother Shoemaker, what does that mean? Does it mean that some people are responsible for certain ones? Why did he not ask the Romans to be a part of it? He didn't. Look what he says in the 15th chapter of the Corinthian letter, of the Roman letter, verses 26 through 28. For Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make some contribution for the poor among the saints at Jerusalem. The word contribution there is the word koinonia. Now he says the ones in Macedonia and Achaia, and incidentally, in all those other churches that Paul says I gave order for them to give, but the church at Rome, you see, he hadn't gotten there yet, and it was so far out of the way that he didn't make any attempt to go by there to take up anything from them for this particular collection. It may have just simply been purely coincidental that they were not a part of it, but it may also have been that their responsibility initially and immediately lay around them. For example, Eugene Underwood gave me something the other day that he had read, that by the year 250, the Roman Church was responsible for supporting 1,500 widows and distressed persons by the year 250. They had 1,500 people on their benevolence roll that they were taking care of. So they had their own Jerusalem experience there in the city of Rome. But look at verses 27 through 28 in chapter 15. They were pleased to do it, and indeed they are in debt to them. Now let's get clear up some of these pronouns. They were pleased to do it. That is, the Macedonians and Achaeans were pleased to do it. And indeed they, that is the Macedonians and Achaeans, are in debt to them, that is the Jewish brethren in Jerusalem. For if the Gentiles have come to share in their spiritual blessings, and the word share in there is the word koinonia again, or it's derived from that, they ought also to be of service to them in material blessings. Now he uses the word service there, which comes from the word diakones, or from which we get our word deacon or servant, and it just simply described what they were doing in terms of koinonia, or in terms of fellowship. He called it a service, a ministry that they were performing to these Jewish Christians. All right, so these are some examples where the word koinonia is actually translated by the word contribution. It's translated specifically and explicitly by the word contribution. So there's no reason for us to have to surmise that he's using the word koinonia to stand for contribution. It's simply there, and it's so obvious that you have to translate it contribution. Now, having laid those few thoughts as groundwork, I want us to look at some guidelines that the Apostle Paul uses and sets for giving. There are about three. One or two of them we're aware of, but let's notice them if you will. First of all, I'm going to state something that I read in a book. And incidentally, there's a book entitled Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger that you need to get for a real thorough treatment of this whole subject. And even it goes into way more detail in other areas also. But it's by a man by the name of Sider, Ronald J. Sider. But he uses an expression. He says that Paul sets down a standard for giving, and he sets the standard or the guideline, give all you can. Give all you can. And I was kind of taken back by that. I didn't know that the Apostle Paul ever said, give all you can. Well, he doesn't in so many words. This man, and obviously he quotes from 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter, where Paul says, as you may have prospered. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so that no contribution needs to be made when I come. Well, how do you get all that you can give out of all as he may prosper? I don't think we've interpreted that statement like that. I think more than likely we have interpreted it much like we express it around the collection every Sunday morning, it seems, that we say, as we pray to God, or as we make comment about it, as we return this small part of what we have been blessed with. Well, now that's usually the way we describe our gift, and it may very well too accurately describe it. It may be that we just give a very small amount. In fact, it may be infinitesimal, the amount that we give in comparison to what God has given to us. If that's true, then we either need to start praying differently, and we need to start giving differently. But Paul, in one respect, says, give all you can give. But he expresses it in such a nebulous term. He says, give according as you've prospered. But what does that mean? That's so nebulous, I don't know what it means. According as you've prospered, that means anything. It's so relative. I don't see how in the world you could say what it really means. And I don't think we can say until we have seen one or two other things. First of all, we must see the reason for Christians working. You know the New Testament gives the reason for Christians working? Look at 1 Thessalonians 4, 10b through 12. Here he talks about, well, he gives the ideal here. 1 Thessalonians 4, 10b through 12. He says, we exhort you, brethren, to do so more and more, that is, about love. Look at verse 10. Indeed, you do love all the brethren throughout Macedonia, but we exhort you, brethren, to do so more and more, to aspire to live quietly, to mind your own business, or mind your own affairs, to work with your hands, as we charged you. Now watch the purpose for it. So that you may command the respect of outsiders and be dependent on nobody. Now that's the ideal. Christ did not call us to make us slothful people who didn't work and who were always looking for a handout. That's not what he wanted. We were called to work so that we might be dependent on no one, so that we might gain the respect of people on the outside. Nobody respects a bum. The ideal is, when you become a Christian, work. Let me show you what I mean by that. Look over at Ephesians 4:28. Ephesians 4:28 takes a person who is not a bum, he's a crook. Ephesians 4 talks to the man that's the thief. Watch how he turns the thing around so he completely turns the table on this particular economic balance or this economic practice. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his hands. Why? So that he may be able to give to those in need. Now watch what he's done. He's changed this man. Here was a man in need. He's out in the world. What does a man who lives by the standard of the world do when he's in need? He steals. That's what he does. If he's living by Satan's principle, he just simply steals. When he's in need and lives by the devil, he steals. Watch what Paul does when he takes this man and converts him to Jesus Christ. Watch this beautiful transition. He said, now those of you who've been stealing as crooks and all out in the world, you quit that stealing now that you've become Christians and start to work so that you can do what? So that you, in turn, can become an instrument for filling the needs of those people who don't have anything. You look what he says now, 4:28. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his hands, so that he may be able to give to those in need. So instead of being a drain on society by force or by stealth, instead of being someone who acts as a leech on society, the Christian, or Christ, takes that person who was the leech, transforms him, places him in the economy of the society, not only as someone who is honest, but as someone who not only works for his own need, he also sees to it that the needs of other people are met. I think that's absolutely beautiful. As it takes this man, turns him round in his tracks, sets him out on a 180-degree different course, and says, okay, now, you thieves, begin working so that you might help those who are in need. Now, that's the reason for a Christian working. We're going to notice again in just a moment, but let's pass it up for right now. Look at some examples in giving. I don't think we can give all you can give out of the expression, as you may prosper, until you've seen the reason that's given for Christians to work, and secondly, until you've seen some examples of what Christian giving really is supposed to be. For example, the Macedonians, look at 2 Corinthians 8. 2 Corinthians 8, the first five verses. Here's an example. It's an approved example. You might also point back to the widow back in the book of Luke chapter 23. We'll not discuss her, but nevertheless, Jesus approved of her gift. But in 2 Corinthians 5, we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands. Excuse me, I'm looking at 5. Look at 8. It's chapter 8. We want you to know, brethren, about the grace of God, which has been shown in the churches of Macedonia. For in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of liberality on their part. For they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own free will, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints. And this, not as we expected, but first they gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. That is an approved example of Christian giving. They gave of their means, but they gave sacrificially of their means, and it says they even gave beyond their means, but they gave themselves first. All right, now, look at the Apostle Paul, though, in a very beautiful example back in Acts, the 20th chapter. And here we find both example and the reason for giving combining themselves in one man's example of giving. And we find what he said about his own hands providing and why they provided. Acts, the 20th chapter, verses 34 and 35. Verse 34 says, "You yourselves know that these hands ministered to my necessities." In other words, he worked and provided his own living. "And to those who were with me, he also provided for those in his own company. In all things I have shown you that by so toiling," what? "One must help himself." No, that's understood. You work to provide your own needs. You just got through saying that. But he says, "I've given you an example that by so toiling, one must help the weak." One must help the weak. Remembering the words of the Lord Jesus, how he said, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." Now, why do you work? Why do we work? Why do I work? Let me ask you another question. Why did the rich man work? Now, I'm talking about the rich man back there who did what with his barns? All righty, what did he do with his barns? His ground brought forth plentifully, and he just, you know, he didn't have any place to put it. So, what did he do? He tore down his barns and built larger barns to take care of whom? To take care of himself, you see. His motive for working wasn't right. The motive that that man had for working, God said, "You're a fool. Right now," he said, "tonight you're going to die." And he said, "Tell me this, all this that you've accumulated, who's going to have it now?" "You're a fool." This man was not rich toward God, Jesus said. So is everyone who heaps up for himself and is not rich toward God. Why do you work? I'm convinced that most of us work and work and work for the purpose of increasing our own storehouse, and we act in essence just like the rich man did. That's not the reason that the New Testament says you're supposed to work. You're supposed to work to provide your needs, but he said your other responsibility is to provide for those that are weak, for those that don't have it. Whenever that kind of an approach is made to economy or to economics, a whole new picture is brought into effect and is focused, and this is what it means. Let me say one more thing. We're to give voluntarily. Now, I think all of us know that. I assume, I'm not going to reflect on your intelligence or to say that you don't understand about giving voluntarily. You know that we don't give a conscript. We don't send out a bill. Now, some places do, by the way. Some places send out a bill and say, you're $150 behind this year. We don't do that. You remember when Ananias was told by Peter, "What you had, while it was yours, was it not still yours?" What's the statement he made? "And after you sold it," he said, "did it not still remain in your power?" That's in Acts 5. Listen to what he says. "While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not at your disposal?" In other words, you could do what you wanted to with it before and after you sold it, Peter said. So actually, he's saying it's to be voluntary. Look over at 2 Corinthians now again. I don't mean to run you back and forth so much, but 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 4, Paul says these Macedonians gave of their own free will. All right? Now, there's a key. They gave of their own free will. And then look over at chapter 8 and verse 8. "I say this not as a command." In other words, legalism is not the answer. Coming in and telling how much each person is supposed to give, that's not the biblical way of giving. It's to be voluntary. It's to give all you can give. As you've prospered out of your own paycheck, give all that you can give. Not build greater barns, tearing down your barns and heaping up for yourself just continually. As you increase your store, that's not the Christian way. The Christian way is bound up in the word koinonia, which means a sharing with one another and a seeing to it that no one is lacking. But now there's a third principle. And this is, I've never preached on this, and I've never heard it preached on. But it's a statement found in this very eighth chapter. And that is, give that there may be equality. Give that there may be equality. Now, that's said twice. Let's just take it. I want to just take it verse by verse. Look at verse 9 of chapter 8 of 2 Corinthians. "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you by his poverty might become rich." We have Jesus' own example of sharing what he had to such a degree that he actually became poor in the process of making us rich. So Here was, now watch, if you will, let's illustrate it. Here was Jesus Christ way up here. He was rich in an immeasurable way. Here we were way down here on this mud ball, this dust bowl, and here we are running around like ants in the sand. And he became so equal with us, it was just the equality of things. He became, in a sense, the great equalizer. He became poor so that we might become rich. He brought us up to his standard. He came down to ours. And here again, we have this fellowship, this koinonia. Jesus' own perfect example. The grace of the Lord Jesus, though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you by his poverty might become rich. Now, verse 10 and 11. He urges us to imitate that example. And in this matter, I give my advice. It is best for you now to complete what a year ago you began not only to do, but to desire, so that your readiness in desiring it may be matched by your completing it out of what you have. All right? Now watch what he did. He just simply says, I want to show you the example of Jesus as he became one who made his giving such that it more or less produced an equality. He says, now I want to ask you to do the same thing. But he says it's to be done out of what you have. In other words, don't get all down in the dumps if you don't have anything to give. Now, that's pretty well what he's saying, because look at the next verse. For if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what a man has, not according to what he has not. Now watch, and then he explains that, but that's a beautiful statement. He just simply says here that the desire to give really is more important than the gift. Or at least it's more important than the amount of the gift. He says if the desire is there or the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what a man has, not according to what he has not. Now, I think he's saying this in order to forestall any kind of an imposition being laid upon people who don't have, making them feel bad because they don't have anything to give. Look, there are some people probably in this very assembly who, instead of putting something in the collection plate when it comes around, need to take something out of it. That's right. There's one congregation in Tennessee, I think, that does that. I'm not sure where it is, but they do it. When the collection plate comes by, most of the people put in, but there are some people, and everybody's free to take something out of the collection plate if they need it. How would you like to go to church somewhere like that? Boy, tuition's due? Yeah. Look, do you trust each other that much or not? Frankly, I don't think that we trust each other enough to do that. I don't believe we have that kind of trust. I don't think we've got that kind of koinonia, that kind of fellowship, where we would live in and out of each other's pockets and let each other either give or take away from the collection. But what about that kind of a spirit that would be so... Wouldn't that be fantastic if a body of people were so closely knit together that they just simply said, here's what I can give, and somebody else said, well, I need something this week, and so they just take it out. That's all right. Good enough. That's fine. Oh, my. Look again. I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened. You see, he's still talking about not wanting anybody to impose upon them and to legislate or to levy some kind of a tax that would be a burden upon those who are poor. I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened. But now look at verse 14. But that as a matter of equality, your abundance at the present time should supply their want, so that their abundance may supply your want. That there may be what? There may be equality. Oh, I've never heard that preached on, ever. I've never done it, and I apologize. That there may be equality. What's he talking about? Now, he's not talking about, evidently, a cent exactness, a dollar exactness of equality, where you have to have 23.05 and the person next to you has 24.05, so he gives 50 cents to you so that you can be both have 23.55. No, that's not what he's talking about. You see, he defines what he means by equality. Look, verse 14. But as a matter of equality, your abundance at the present time should supply their want, so that their abundance may supply your want, that there may be equality. So you see, he's just simply saying that times vary. They differ. There are times when you've got some extra money. Fine, give it. There are other times when you don't have it. There are other times when you don't have money. That's all right, too. As you have some extra money, give it in order to supply their want. Because the time will come when you don't have what you need, and they will have what they need, and they'll have some extra. So whenever you're in need, then they can supply that. That's what he means by equality. Equality of opportunity to both give and to receive. And equality in the sense that everyone has access to whatever he needs in order to get along through life. And some will have it at one time and others at another time. And then by all of us pooling our resources, he says, that's what I'm talking about equality. Now, he doesn't just leave it there. In verse 15, he says, as it is written, he who gathered much had nothing over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Well, where in the world is that found? Well, it's found way back in Exodus, the 16th chapter. If you brought your whole Bible, look back at Exodus, the 16th chapter. And let me just kind of tell you what he's doing. You know what it's talking about. Whenever manna became that by which God fed the people, in giving them instructions on how much to take, he said, I want you to gather a certain amount. Let's see, how much was it? Well, is it 4 omer? Well, okay. On the morrow, Moses sat to judge the people. That's verse 13. And the people stood about Moses from morning till evening. Excuse me, I'm in verse 8, chapter 18. I'll get it in a minute. It's chapter 16, verses 15 through 18. Okay. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? That's what the word manna means. Isn't that... That's so funny. That's what they named it. All through those years of in the wilderness, they called it, what is it? Let's go get a bowl of what is it? Because they had seen it before. And they said, what is that? And so they just called it, what is it? So they said, let's go get a bowl of what is it? What? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it's the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, every man of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer apiece, according to the number of persons whom each of you has in his tent. So each person was to receive an omer full. Now, an omer was something like a quart or so. Now, what happened, though, some of them gathered more than an omer. And they had it left over. And worms got in it. It began to smell. It went foul. It soured on them. And it made Moses angry. They didn't do like he told them. But they said, just get a bowl. Everybody get a bowl full. Now, he said, those that gathered too much, when they went to measure it, though, they didn't have any more than those who didn't have enough. It just simply seemed that every person, regardless of how much he gathered, everybody came out with an equal portion. And then they left some of it over through the night, and it soured the next day. But the point he's making here is he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Well, now, why would he refer to that as a scriptural illustration of the way Christians are to conduct their economic affairs in the church? Why would he refer to that? Because that was an example of how God desired equality among the members of the body. Now, if that's not what it means, that's as clear as any passage on baptism ever was. That's right. Now, look, I don't know all the answers. But thank God I'm at least beginning to see some of the questions. What is our responsibility toward members of the body? I'm convinced that it can be summed up in this simple language. We are to be always available to them, and we are to be totally liable for them. Total liability to them, total availability to them. And when that time comes, you're going to see such a fantastically beautiful relationship of people living in harmony with one another that it's going to transform the world whenever the church comes in contact with the world. And let me tell you something. We're heading for some real rough economic times. I'm not being a pessimist, and I'm certainly not a doomsday prophet. But if I know those Arabs, they're going to push our nose in it. And they're going to up the price of oil to the point that it causes some real serious economic repercussions, not only in America, but around the world. It's already happening. And don't think for a moment that you and I are going to escape the repercussions of that. We're not. There's a certain strata, and I don't know where it will reach, but there's a strata among us that's going to be so affected by it economically, you're going to lose your jobs. We're going to be pushed to such financial and economic stress, in such a stress, that it's going to cause economic chaos. Now, what's going to happen, perhaps, is this. There's going to be an increasing number of us out of work. And there's going to then emerge a class of people who, over the years, have been very successful in accumulating quite a bit of money and property. Now, the question stares us in the face, and I want you to be prepared for it because I think it's coming. I don't know how many years away it is, but you and I are going to be put to the same test that the Jerusalem church was, and that the church in Macedonia and the church in Corinth, wherever the Christians were in that first century, we're going to be put to that test. Will I hold on to what I've got and tell my brothers in the Lord, that's just your tough luck, I'm sorry, come back and see me later on, but I can't give you anything? Or will we start selling what we've got and start filling each other's needs? What are you going to do? I think it's a question that deserves your immediate attention because it's coming. And for us to think that just because America has always had an increasing standard of living, that it's always going to continue, is absolutely sheer lunacy. In fact, on the television set yesterday, it said from now on, for the first time in America's history, we are beginning to see the shrinking of the American standard of living. We're not going to be continuing our increase. All right, most of you students, you don't understand that, and you won't be caught in it perhaps right now, but you'll be caught in it later. But next Sunday, we're going to notice some things that might help you even avoid even getting in a predicament. And it'll help you learn how to give perhaps before you get to that highest earning peak of your life. Okay, those of us who are well situated in our lives, I say we're well situated, we're settled in, we're middle-aged, we're in our peak earning periods, we need to be giving consideration as to what is our motive for working and what are we going to do when the economic situation becomes such that there are going to be brethren in the body right here under our nose as well as those outside our area who are in need of our financial help. We better be watchful because our responsibility before God is serious, and we're going to have to give an answer for what we have.